component. With the technology advances of the 20th century, however, a new form of warfare had emerged. It was swifter and bloodier than anything that had gone before. The airplane, the automobile, the submarine, and chemical weaponry had forever changed the manner by which grievances would be redressed on the battlefield.
General Stephen Burkheiser is executive director of the Liberty Memorial in Kansas City, Missouri.
Nations were putting their whole economies, their whole energies, both in terms of scientific and technological development, into those things that were necessary to fight war on a global scale. You have the introduction of machine guns, for example, on a large scale, where a single machine gun might have the same effectiveness of 200 riflemen in a previous conflict. There was submarine warfare developing the tactics of economic strangulation. You could bring someone to their knees by stopping the flow of goods. Aviation, communications, and the scientific development of weapons that we would now call weapons of mass destruction.
The effects of such a conflict could only be imagined. What had not changed were the methods of international diplomacy. Centuries-old treaties bound the European powers in a complex tangle of alliances. These had been strained by regional conflicts and seething ambitions. The nations of Europe were in a race for great power supremacy. Each of the old monarchies, though often related by blood, vied to become the dominant land power on the continent. It was against the backdrop of accelerating technological and political change that on June 20th in Sarajevo, a Serbian nationalist named Gavril Princip assassinated Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne. Political assassination was not new in the Balkans. What was new were the complex relationships that existed among the great powers. Austria used the incident as a pretext for waging war against Serbia, and it was prudent in seeking the support of its ally, Germany. Kaiser Wilhelm II offered Austria-Hungary his country's unconditional support, and so began a political chain reaction that swept through the capitals of Europe. When Austria sought the support of Germany, it was to protect itself from Serbia's formidable ally to the east, the mighty Russian army. Pledged to stand behind Russia was France, and pledged to France was Great Britain. Ultimatums were exchanged and armies were mobilized. No means of diplomacy existed to defuse the mounting tension. No mediator stepped in to avert the cataclysm that lay ahead. Exactly 1 month after the Archduke's assassination, the armies of Europe marched into war.
You probably can't find many World War I scholars who would say these are the causes of World War I. But the one thing that they all seem to agree on is that it was absolutely a horrific diplomatic failing, that it really didn't have to happen. During the Vietnam War, there were popular expressions, what if somebody gave a war and nobody came? It's an interesting concept. But in the case of World War I, someone gave a war and everybody came. And they all thought it was going to be short, that there was going to be some glory, some spoils to be divided. But it wasn't that there were great war aims or a compelling case for anybody to have to go to war.
Lady Margaret Asquith, wife of Prime Minister Henry Asquith, recalls the night Great Britain entered the war.
After dinner, I joined my husband in the cabinet room. The windows were all open. We sat without speaking and listened to the distant sound of thousands and thousands of people singing and cheering outside the railings of Buckingham Palace. Then Big Ben struck. The crowd outside seemed to be singing and cheering everywhere. But inside the cabinet room, it was silent as dawn. I left to go to bed. We were at war.
Military strategists in Russia, Germany, and France had been preparing for this event decades before Gavrilo Princip fired into the Archduke's motorcade. France had formulated a plan which it believed would cripple German industry. Russia had a plan for how to handle a simultaneous assault from Germany and Austria-Hungary. But it was a German strategy that would determine the course and the nature of the Great War. Some 20 years before, Alfred von Schlieffen, the German Army Chief of Staff, had created a plan for how Germany could successfully fight a war on two fronts. The Schlieffen plan called for a quick, sweeping attack on France through Belgium. It would cripple the French army and allow Germany to concentrate its military might on the advancing Russian army in the east.
Dr. William Adams of the University of Texas, Brownsville, Texas Southmost College.
The Schlieffen plan is, typically Germanic. I mean, that was planned down to the day, to the hour. The number of trains, for instance, that were scheduled to bring up that army, I think it was 16,400 to be brought up in the 30 days. But the timetable needed to do that on the, using the German rail network was a piece of art, the way they had worked that out. And, of course, had Schlieffen's plan been followed, had they not modified it, I mean, it came within an ounce of succeeding as it was.
Schlieffen did not live to see the implementation of his strategy, nor did he see its failure as the German army encountered the stubborn resistance of the tiny Belgian army. With the arrival of the armies of France and Great Britain, the fighting deadlocked, moving from the battlefield to the trenches. And so it would be until the end of the war. Conceived as temporary shelters, these trenches would soon stretch some 500 miles from the Swiss frontier to the North Sea. The First World War would be characterized as a war of attrition. Gains were measured not in terms of miles, but of yards. Armies gathered in opposing trenches with the single goal of wearing down the manpower and reserves of the enemy. It was a slow, grinding method of warfare that would result in the death of millions. The trenches remain one of the lasting images of World War I. Here the soldiers lived, ate, slept, and fought in conditions that often defied the imagination.
We must look out for our bread. The rats have become much more numerous lately because the trenches are no longer in good condition. The rats here are particularly repulsive. They are so fat, the kind we call corpse rats. They have shocking, evil, naked faces, and it is nauseating to see their long, nude tails.
Whilst asleep during the night, we were frequently awakened by rats running over us. When this happened too often for my liking, I would lie on my back and wait for a rat to linger on my legs, then violently heave my legs upward, throwing the rat into the air. Occasionally I would hear a grunt when the rat landed on a fellow victim.
If you have never had a trench foot described to you, I will explain. Your feet swell 2 to 3 times their normal size and go completely dead. You can stick a bayonet into them and no feel a thing. It is then that the most incredible agony begins. I have heard men cry and scream with pain, and many have had to have their feet and leg amputated. I was one of the lucky ones, but one more day in that trench, and it may have been too late.
The water in the trenches through which we waded was alive with a multitude of swimming frogs. Red slugs crawled up the side of the trenches, and strange beetles with dangerous-looking horns wriggled along dry ledges and invaded the dugouts in search of the lice that infested them.
Modern recoil mechanisms allowed gunners to shoot off round after round in rapid succession. At the Battle of the Somme in July 1916, artillery crews fired at an incredible rate of 1 million shells a day. The losses on each side were incredible. On July 1st, the British Army saw the worst day in its history, with 19,000 dead in a single day. The conflict that was expected to end by Christmas had bogged down into what would be the bloodiest war yet seen in human history.
I suddenly heard a horrid hum and whiz close to my ear, As I went on, there were more hums from bullets possibly overhead. My stretcher bearers were more shaken than I was even, and did not sleep a bit, but sat round a room in silence, hating the whole thing. We are all new to it, and I felt very sorry for them. At first, the zip-zip of bullets hitting the sandbags was rather disconcerting. Then it became just part of the general environs.
To break the stalemate, the Germans introduced the first chemical weapons in modern warfare. At the Belgian town of Ypres, a strange fog crept across no man's land toward the French trenches. Blinded and choking, the French retreated as more than 5,000 cylinders of chlorine gas were deployed. It opened up a hole in the Allied defense 4.5 miles long.
The gaseous vapor, which the Germans used against the French divisions near Ypres last Thursday, contrary to the rules of the Hague Convention, introduces a new element into warfare. The attack of last Thursday evening was preceded by the rising of a cloud of vapor. That vapor settled to the ground like a swamp mist and drifted toward the French trenches on a brisk wind. Its effect on the French was a violent nausea and faintness, followed by an utter collapse. It is believed that the Germans, who charged in behind the vapor, met no resistance at all, the French at their front being virtually paralyzed.
Early use of gas was unreliable. The wind could carry it in any direction, killing friend and foe. But gas would later be deployed with greater accuracy by artillery shell. Soon, more lethal forms of chemical weaponry, such as phosgene and mustard gas, would be developed by both sides.
The effects of the noxious trench gas seemed to be slow in wearing away. The men came out of their nausea in a state of utter collapse. Some of the rescue have already died from the after effect. How many of the men left unconscious in the trenches died from the fumes? It is impossible to say, since those trenches were at once occupied by the Germans.
Another war was being fought on the home front. Nations mobilized their entire populations. The purpose was to keep their armies and navies supplied with weapons, ammunition, clothing, and food. Civilians became targets for enemy raids far behind the front lines. The Germans shelled French and Belgian cities with long-range artillery and bombarded Britain from battleships and Zeppelin airships. Britain's navy blockaded Germany, starving it of food and raw materials for its industry. Germany's solution to the blockade was unrestricted submarine warfare. It hoped to break the Allied home front before the German home front gave way. Thousands of tons of shipping went to the bottom of the ocean. Adolf von Spiegel commanded a German U-boat during the First World War. Here he describes the attack on a cargo vessel in April 1916.
The steamer appeared to be close to us and looked colossal. I saw the captain walking on his bridge, a small whistle in his mouth. I saw the crew cleaning the deck forward, and I saw, with surprise and a slight shudder, long rows of wooden partitions right along all decks, from which gleamed the shining black and brown backs of horses. Oh, heavens, horses! What a pity, those lovely beasts! But it cannot be helped. I went on thinking, war is war, and every horse, the fewer on the Western Front, is a reduction in England's fighting power. I must acknowledge, however, the thought of what must come was a most unpleasant one.
Among the casualties was a ship of the Cunard Line, the Lusitania, which was torpedoed off the coast of Ireland on May 7, 1915. 1,200 civilians perished, many of them women and children. Across the Atlantic, Americans were horrified. President Woodrow Wilson had maintained a policy of neutrality toward the war. But the German attacks on merchant shipping and the sinking of the Lusitania brought the war ever closer to American shores. Wilson's Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, condemned the German submarine attacks in no uncertain terms.
"We could not believe that Germany would do what she said she would do upon the seas. Yet we still hear the piteous cries of children coming out of the sea where the Lusitania went down. And Germany has never asked forgiveness of the world. We saw the Sussex sunk, crowded with the sons and daughters of neutral nations. We saw ship after ship sent to the bottom, ships of mercy bound out of America for the Belgian starving, ships carrying the Red Cross and laden with the wounded of all nations, murdered against all law without warning.
Germany suspended its policy of unlimited submarine warfare for a time, but by now the majority of Americans had sided with the cause of the Allied powers. It was helped in part by British and French propaganda aimed at stirring the United States, the sleeping giant, into action. Rumors began circulating of Germans parading through Belgian towns with babies on the ends of bayonets. One headline of the period read, "Germans crucify Canadian officer." President Wilson remained firm in his policy of neutrality. He cited George Washington's farewell address, in which he advised against getting involved in foreign entanglements. But many Americans felt differently. Between 1914 and 1917, some 15,000 young men and women slipped across the border. They joined the Canadian Army or signed up for the French Ambulance and Nursing Service, as did Ernest Hemingway, E.E. Cummings, and Gertrude Stein. For many medical volunteers, it was a brutal awakening to the realities of modern warfare.
A broken-down horse appeared with a cartload of what looked like old clothes. I'd never seen a dead body till that moment. It was a horrible awakening. Eight stiff, semi-detached, armless, trunkless, headless bodies. A grave had been dug 2 meters deep, large enough to hold 16. Then one by one they were lowered into the grave, and when they were all laid out, the identification started to take place, and the good boots were taken off, and if a coat was not too bloody or torn, it was kept.
On the Eastern Front, the well-trained German army dealt easily with the large but ill-equipped Russian army. In 1914, Russia had the largest army in the world, with 1.5 million men. But many were now fighting without arms or ammunition. At the Battle of Tannenberg in August 1914, a force of 150,000 was shattered. Only 10,000 Russian soldiers left the battlefield. With more and more civilians being conscripted into the Russian army, harvests failed and famine spread through the land. A monk and seer named Rasputin had warned Tsar Nicholas that if he entered the war, Russia would lose and the Romanov dynasty would come to an end. His prophecy would be borne out by the Bolshevik Revolution, a direct consequence of the bloodletting taking place along the Eastern Front. The armies of Europe remained in what looked like a permanent deadlock. The battle lines had changed scarcely at all since 1914, and still the war dragged on. Towns in France and Belgium would become synonymous with wholesale slaughter. At the Battle of the Somme in 1916, the British introduced the tank, but without significantly affecting the battle's 1 million casualties. Morale eroded within the ranks. At Verdun, more than 40,000 French infantrymen refused to fight. Penalties for mutiny and desertion were swift and severe.
The private of the South Staffordshire Regiment was tried on the following charges: misbehaving in such a manner as to show cowardice. The accused, when proceeding with a party for work in the trenches, ran away, owing to the bursting of a shell, and did not rejoin the party. The sentence of the court was to suffer death by being shot.
The spirit of dissent spread across both sides of the trenches. Camaraderie began to flourish between opposing forces. Realizing the futility of the eye-for-an-eye policy of attrition, they would sometimes seek to limit the casualties on both sides by signaling to each other before launching an assault. Or they simply refused to fire. By 1917, 2.5 years after an assassin's bullet lit the powder keg that would become the First World War, there was no end in sight. The Bolshevik Revolution in February had taken Russia out of the war and relaxed Germany's Eastern Front. It allowed the Kaiser to send the bulk of his troops to tip the balance in the West. And yet the British naval blockade of Germany had left the Germans in desperate need of munitions and food. Events in Russia pointed to the possibility of revolution on the German home front. Germany's only option was to resume unrestricted submarine warfare. It was a policy which Germany knew would have immediate repercussions across the Atlantic.
The determination to launch the unrestricted U-boat war depends then upon the results which we may expect. Admiral von Holzendorf assumes that we will have England on her knees by next harvest. The experiences of the U-boats during the last few months, the increased number of U-boats, and England's bad economic situation will at least increase our chances of success. The U-boat war is a very serious question. We will have to calculate upon America's entrance into the war against us.
President Wilson had been re-elected the year before on the platform, "He kept us out of the war." Even in early 1917, Wilson vowed that America was too proud to fight. But as American merchant ships were sent to the bottom of the sea, both the interest and the dignity of the United States were at stake. American public opinion had swung swiftly in favor of war. Germany's hostile intentions had been made abundantly clear when a telegram was intercepted on January 16, 1917. In it, the German Foreign Minister Alfred Zimmermann proposed an alliance with Mexico. President Wilson was a peace-loving man, reluctant to commit American money and American lives to someone else's war. But the Great War had now become America's problem as well. And as the urgency of the situation presented itself, he realized there was but one clear alternative. On April 6, 1917, the United States declared war on Germany.
You're listening to the World War I Living History Project. Major funding for the World War I Living History Project is provided by the South Padre Island, Texas Convention and Visitors Bureau. South Padre Island is consistently ranked as one of the best beaches in the United States, and Mexico is right next door. Be yourself in a place you really want to be. 1-800-SO-PADRE or online at sopadre.com. And by the University of Texas Brownsville, Texas Southmost College. Located at historic Fort Brown, UTBTSC serves a student body of 12,000, offering courses from associate and baccalaureate degrees to graduate classes and continuing education. The University of Texas Brownsville, Texas Southmost College, where everything becomes possible. Online at utb.edu.
They will not even come because our submarines will sink them. America, from a military point of view, means nothing. And again, nothing. And for a third time, nothing.
Coming up, an unprepared America enters the war, losing its innocence but gaining a world-class army. This is the story of World War I as remembered by its last eyewitnesses.
The war was on in Europe. Germany was knocking the heck out of everything.
When we went into the war, why, it was quite a popular thing for a young man to do.
I said, what the hell? Look at all these guys, 18, 19, 20, 21. I'm going to join the Army.
Of course, the old veterans keep dying off, and the young people are coming up, and they haven't gone through that, so they don't know.
There were coming fast and furious. Bombs are falling everywhere.
In 1917, the United States committed itself to the Allied cause in Europe. It was a decision reached at first reluctantly and then with outrage when Germany threatened both the country's maritime commerce and the security of its border with Mexico. The future Republican President Warren G. Harding was no great fan of the Wilson administration, but for a moment party lines had blurred as America rolled out its first military operation over there.
Over there, over there.
The Republic must awaken. The people must understand. The fate of the nation and the safety of the world will be decided on the western battlefront of Europe. Primarily, the American Republic has entered the war in defense of its national rights. A republic worth living in is worth fighting for and sacrificing for and dying for.
We're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over, over there, over there.
No military had ever set out on such a high-minded course with such limited resources. At the time, the U.S. Army numbered only 108,000, ranking 17th in the world. The Marine Corps numbered only 15,000, and these troops were already deployed in other parts of the globe. President Wilson had hoped that the American commitment would be one of supplies and materiel, but from the Allies came the cry, "We need men." Limited conscription had taken place during the Civil War, but for the first time in May 1917, Wilson signed a law requiring men aged 21 to 29 to register for the draft. The age would later be extended to ages 18 to 35. Many would never receive the call. But when it came, usually in the form of a telegram, it often gave only a few days' notice. George Johnson, at 112 years old, is the oldest man in California. He was living in Philadelphia in 1917 when his number came up.
He saw this note under the door. Father picked it up and looked at it. It was a letter from the government, from a draft voter, for me to report 6 o'clock in the morning. That was the next morning. I said, "Look," I said, I got this letter," and I showed you the letter. "Yeah, yeah, that's for you. Come on, get on the train." I said, "Look, I have to go home and get some clothes. You don't need any clothes. We got plenty of clothes where you're going."
Between 1917 and 1918, some 24 million men would fill out the lengthy application form required at the time. This form, which went into great detail about the applicant's family background, health, and economic status, would provide future historians with a valuable demographic profile of the wartime generation. General Stephen Burkheiser.
The fact is, draft registration today is quite simple. It's just a postcard. But in 1917, when the U.S. instituted the draft registration form was 12 pages long.
As in future wars, draftees had no say in where they would be sent. Because of this, many chose to enlist, including 109-year-old Ernest Pusey.
I enlisted when I was 21. I enlisted in the Navy because I didn't want to be in the trenches. If you're in the Navy, you're out of the trenches.
Lloyd Brown, a 105-year-old veteran living outside Bethesda, Maryland, also chose to enlist in the Navy, though for different reasons.
I was 16, but I told him I was 18. I was 2 years younger than my record shows. He sent me to Great Lakes, Illinois, for a little basic training, maybe 30 days. Then they put me on a battleship, New Hampshire. One of my ship's duties was to look for submarines. That was our job. Most all the young people were doing it at that time. When we went into the war, why, it was quite a popular thing for a young man to do, is to enlist during the war. That's why I went in, because a lot of other young people like myself were going in. Very popular among the young ladies, too, and I wasn't following the war very much.
But not all enlistees were sent overseas. With the Zimmerman telegram and the possibility of a war with Germany along America's southern border, cavalry soldiers were needed along the border from Texas to the Pacific coast. Like many recruits, Samuel Goldberg was looking for adventure. At 106, Rhode Island's oldest veteran recalls how his choice ultimately went with the cavalry.
I said, "What the hell? Look at all these guys, 18, 19, 20, 21. I'm going to join the Army." And I went to the recruiting office. I understood that they could use where the Signal Corps, there was such a place known as Signal Corps. That's a dangerous spot. You're up there giving signals and they shoot at you. It occurred to me, here was the dangerous part of being the soldier. That's for me. So I go downtown and I say, I want to join the Army and I want to join the Signal Corps. And the recruiting sergeant, pretty smart guy, he said, nah, join the cavalry. Cavalry? Horses? Hey, wait a minute, I have no experience with horses. But what happened here was they were told, get cavalry recruits, we need them badly. So I said, okay, if that's what you want.
1 year before America's entry into global war, the first foreign attack had taken place on U.S. soil. After a failed bid for the Mexican presidency, a bandit and revolutionary named Pancho Villa, hoping to provoke the U.S. into a war with Mexico, raided the small border town of Columbus, New Mexico, killing 11 and leaving the town in ruins. In response, President Wilson deployed 15,000 cavalry troops to the border and sent a punitive expedition into Mexico. The expedition was led by Brigadier General John J. Pershing. Dr. Anthony Knopp is Professor Emeritus at the University of Texas, Brownsville, Texas Southmost College.
When Pershing took his expedition into Mexico, there was great concern along the border about possible retaliation on the part of some Mexican entity or other. And then the Zimmerman telegram, when that became public, when Wilson made that public, then, of course, that caused an even greater panic because the reward for Mexico joining in on the side of Germany should the United States get into the First World War was the lost provinces of Mexico, which included Texas.
Whether the Mexican government ever seriously considered Germany's offer is still a subject of debate. Dr. William Adams.
Had the Germans appeared closer to victory than they did at that moment, the Mexicans might have given that some thought. It wasn't certain who was going to win the war in 1917. And, of course, the consequences for the Mexicans to act on that telegram, actually engage the U.S., and then have the Allies victorious, it would have been disastrous for Mexico.
Samuel Goldberg was posted to the border fort at Hachita, New Mexico.
It's exactly 50 miles west of Columbus, where Pancho Villa shot up the station. This is 1916, in June. He came into midnight, into Columbus, and shot up the works and killed some people. After that, he was known as Villa the Bandit. There was a definite enmity between Mexico and the U.S., especially the Pancho Villa thing. After the raid on Columbus, General Pershing, he was then a brigadier, he had a party of cavalry, and he went after Villa in Mexico. He spent, I don't know whether he spent a week there or a month or 2 months there. He'd never find Villa in Mexico, not among the hills of Mexico. That's when we first heard of Pershing.
Pershing's mission never encountered Pancho Villa, but Villa had achieved his goal of arousing the U.S. military into action, which would provide a training ground for the larger events which were about to unfold. Along the way, a general of no particular prestige had become a public figure, a symbol of the American fighting spirit. The following year, General Pershing would command the American Expeditionary Force in Europe.
Army of American boys is streaming across the sea and taking its place beside the British and the French, I saw the heroic associates with whom our own army is to fight. And I had then, as I have now, a sense of stirring and rising pride in the feeling that America's great and splendidly equipped and prepared army is composed of men worthy to be classed with those heroes, and that they will find heroes worthy of their fellowship.
So spoke U.S. Secretary of War Newton Baker in 1917. But the U.S. Army was anything but prepared. In numbers, it ranked just behind Portugal. An aggressive enlistment campaign and a federal draft would soon increase its number of active duty soldiers to more than 4.5 million. Those who couldn't serve in the military were encouraged to support the war effort through massive fundraising drives. Oil tycoon and philanthropist John D. Rockefeller.
Do you want to see the flower of the manhood of this country, which has brought everlasting glory to our nation, neglected in the hour of its greatest need? I confidently believe that the American people will stand solidly behind the men in uniform, and that they will regard it a privilege to contribute to the limit.
General Pershing sent his own rallying cry from the battlefields of France in this rare wax recording.
3,000 miles from home, an American army is fighting for you. Everything you hold worthwhile is at stake. Only the hardest blows can win against the enemy we are fighting. Invoking the spirit of our forefathers, the Army asks your unflinching support to the end that the high ideals for which America stands may endure upon the earth.
Support for those high ideals ran strong, and the recruitment rolls soon swelled. Those who were not yet old enough to enlist found creative ways of beating the system. Among the World War I veterans living today are a number of these underage soldiers, like John Babcock, an American citizen who joined the Canadian Army when he was only 15 and a half.
The Canadians were hard up for men. They didn't have conscription. Of course, a lot of young men were reluctant to sign up and go to war. Of course, at the age that I didn't know any better, and I was 15 and a half years old, and I was a good-sized kid, and they asked me if I'd like to, and I said yes. So I signed up, and I got a physical, and I was physically fit, but I was underage, so my category was A4. Well, for some reason or other, my name wasn't called by the people that were turned down. So I put my pack on and got on the train, and we got to England, and they rounded up all the kids in the Canadian Army that were underage. There were 1,300 of us, and they sent us to Bexhill-on-Sea, that's in Sussex, and they called us the Young Soldiers Battalion.
We know you love your land of liberty. We know you love your USA. But if you want the world to know...
The popular music of the time acted as a rallying cry, encouraging young men to do their part for Uncle Sam in the war effort, as in this song, For Your Country and My Country, by the Peerless Quartet.
It's your country, it's my country, with millions of real fighting men. And it is your duty and my duty to speak with the sword, not the pen.
At the start of the war, only men over 21 years of age were drafted. But enlistments in the Army were accepted as young as 18, the route chosen by 107-year-old Homer Anderson.
I was pretty young. I was too young to be drafted. So I decided what I'd do is enlist, and I did.
At 108, Howard Ramsey of Portland, Oregon, is one of only three living U.S. veterans to have seen action in the trenches in France. Like many aspiring soldiers, he joined up with a friend.
I went up to enlist. My buddy and I, we were too young, you know. No, we were too underweight. That was it. We was underweight. So we went out and ate a lot of bananas and went back and we passed. I don't think we'd had our 18th birthday.
The youngest American World War I veteran, Frank Buckles, is 105. After lying about his age to get into the Marines and then the Army, he finally settled on the ambulance corps.
I went to the recruiting station for the Marine Corps. The nice sergeant told me that I just wasn't old enough. I had to be 21. So I'll try elsewhere. I went to Oklahoma City. There, they asked for my birth certificate. I explained that when I was born in Missouri, there were no public records. It was in the family Bible. They took me at that and sent me out to Fort Logan, Colorado, to enlist in the regular army. The sergeant there said, if you want to get to France in a hurry, join the ambulance corps, because the French are asking for ambulance service. I did, and they sent me to Fort Riley, Kansas, where I had training in trench retrieval and for French ambulance service.
He was stationed at Winchester, England, which for the ambitious 16-year-old ambulance driver was not enough. France, of course, was where the action was and where he wanted to be.
As much as I liked England, I wanted to get on to France. I appealed to everybody. Oh, I was here working every scheme I could.
And yet, with carnage reaching sometimes unimaginable dimensions along the Western Front, the U.S. media was often hesitant to portray the true nature of the suffering. Soldiers training for combat often had little idea of what lay ahead. George Johnson.
You didn't even know what was going on, you know what I mean, in the war. They never told you anything at all about, never heard no newspapers, no nothing. Didn't tell you a thing about, I guess they just didn't want us to know about it, you know what I mean? They didn't want us to know about what was going on.
John Babcock recalls an aspect of the new warfare that had become a common part of every soldier's training, chemical warfare.
We had to go through the gas chamber. They give us gas masks, and the skirt of the mask would be under the collar of your coat, and you'd button it up around it. We actually went through where there was gas, lethal gas, but you had that gas mask on. We had a captain, and he had been gassed. It affected his speech. He couldn't give a loud command.
Howard Ramsey.
It was a court-martial offense. He was caught without a gas mask. So we were under that threat all day and night. As I remember, smelling mustard. I think we called it a mustard gas, if I remember right.
J. Russell Coffey, who turned 108 in September 2006, was another enlistee eager to see action in France.
I had two brothers, or I had been over in the front line. They were trying to keep me out of it. My older brother was out on the Western Front, but my other brother got sick on his way over, and after he got to France, they sent him home. Just like everybody else, the boys were going. I wanted to go too.
American infantrymen had been fondly called doughboys since the time of the Civil War, though the origins of the term are shrouded. Some say it refers to the dough-like adobe buildings that often housed Army soldiers at remote outposts in the 19th century. Others, that it refers to the dough-like globular buttons on early uniforms. Whatever the origins, by the 4th of July 1917, General Pershing was marching his first unit of AEF doughboys down the Champs-Élysées in Paris. By the year's end, 10,000 robust American servicemen were arriving in Europe each day. Dr. William Adams.
It was enough to tip the balance very quickly towards the Allied side. Not only was it the numbers of troops that we sent, but they came in with strong morale, fresh troops when the French and British soldiers had been ground down by this for many years.
General Pershing would not let his men be drawn into Allied skirmishes. Resisting the call by France and Great Britain to join the Allies, he made it clear that American soldiers would not simply fill gaps left in the Allied lines. The American Expeditionary Force would be an independent fighting unit, operating on its own terms and with its own tactics. His maverick attitude caused the Allied commanders to bristle at what they perceived as American arrogance. And yet, his approach would set a pattern for America's involvement in another European war 2.5 decades later. 3.5 years of trench fighting had reduced much of Belgium and France into a stew of mud and barbed wire and human carnage. 110-year-old Tony Piero was an Italian immigrant who saw enlistment as a chance for quick American citizenship. He saw action in the Battle of Saint-Mihiel and the Meuse-Argonne offensive, two battles in which U.S. participation proved decisive in pushing back the German line and rebuilding morale among the Allied troops. The fighting in the Argonne Forest was particularly brutal, with American mortality during the first 3 weeks of fighting running an average of 1,000 lives a day. 90 years later, Piero's eyes still mist over when he recalls those 3 deadly weeks.
I wasn't afraid to get killed. I'd go through anything. But I came back. I came out alive and well. A lot of the fellows, they lost an arm, a leg, they went blind. A lot of them fellows, too bad. I want to forget all those bad days. You think the next minute your life is over. Every day, life, it was there to get killed. Thank God I come out alive. Many of my brothers, they kicked the bucket.
One of Howard Ramsey's fondest memories of France was when he was waiting outside his military vehicle to drive an officer somewhere, and a little French girl came by and sat in his car and asked him for a souvenir. He said he didn't have anything, but looked around and gave her an American penny, and she gave him a little gift wrapped in tissue. As she left, he looked in the tissue and found a lock of her curly hair. He still has that lock of hair, but he also carries with him memories of the trenches and the relentless shelling that characterized the latter part of the war.
Remember, we were back to the trenches, and we were shelled every night. And I remember one time, we were in a little town, and we couldn't go in it because they held us up. And the only place to sleep there was in the cemetery. I can remember sleeping in between there, but kept the wind off of it. And I don't know how many nights we slept there.
Ramsey was one of the few men who could drive, an unusual skill in 1917.
Nobody drove. We had to teach one of those guys how to drive. Those guys couldn't drive a nail. And we had to teach them how to drive, and we were under shell fire half the time, and it wasn't very pleasant, I'll tell you.
The lot of most American doughboys in Europe was to serve in the trenches, where the stakes grew higher, and the fighting became more and more desperate.
They were coming fast and furious. Bombs were falling everywhere. So you had a duck. It was just like a dream. I'm glad it was I'll never see it again.
The 3-week Meuse-Argonne offensive was a key battle for the United States and the Allies, coming at a time when the German resistance was breaking. The balance was already tipping in the favor of the Allies due to the fresh, energetic U.S. troops. But the Germans weren't yet willing to capitulate, responding with deadly shelling.
And out of the escape, a trap, I'd dress up like a civilian, and they wouldn't recognize me, like a spy, you know, get all the information you could get, different movements of the enemy. That's a dangerous job. I got away. I got out of the danger spot. A shell would come in and it'd kill half a dozen soldiers. A bunch of fellows would get killed, and they put another bunch. It just changed them over. It's no good. It's better to be at peace and have beer together.
The oldest living World War I veteran to have seen combat experience is also the oldest man living in the continental United States. Moses Hardy is 113 years old. As an African American, he served in a segregated unit, the 805th Pioneer Infantry. While he was unable to speak during his interview for this program, his son, Haywood Hardy, related a family legend handed down by his father about Army food on the combat lines.
Now, he used to tell us that he believed... When he first got older, he was scared to death. But he said he thanked that they used to feed them something to make them brave. And after a while, he wasn't scared of nothing. Bullets just flying everywhere. You run, duck, but you wasn't scared. So it had to be something. You tell them about, you see old green water there, and you take your canteen and dip down in there, and then you had a peel to put in there to purify it. Shake it up good, and... drank it, go right on. It didn't make you sick, that pill. He used to tell me, too, about lunches, hard tacks and stuff like that little packet of food, little box about that long, little flat, and you when you eat that whatever in that little box, you be full. He had it fully packed. Little can of ham, little can of chicken, hardtack bread, about four cigarettes being there, another little can of what you call pudding or pie. And when you eat all of it, you'll be full.
Moses Hardy entered the war in May 1918. After the armistice, the colored soldiers were among those who were kept behind to identify the dead and clean up the battlefields. Then, as now, returning veterans often had trouble shaking off their combat experience and the memories.
He was a pretty strong old man. Yeah. I know shortly after he come out of the war, he used to fall out, walk along and fall out, like faint. And then he'd lay there a while and get up and go head on. But as he got older, he didn't do that no more. He used to tell about so many of his buddies got killed all around him. But he survived. He believed in the Lord, so he said the Lord saved him, you know. I guess them fellas believed on him too, but they had to go.
You're listening to the World War I Living History Project. Coming up in the second hour,
there were nails and there were halter nails, and they were prone to do what a halter nail would do.
Oh, yeah, big celebration, yeah. Hugs and kisses from the girls on the streets.
Katie, beautiful Katie.
The armistice, the Treaty of Versailles, and 4.5 million soldiers are matriculated into civilian life. We'll take an in-depth look at the lives of the war's last surviving veterans, Americans whose lives spanned three centuries, when the World War I Living History Project continues. For photos and video clips, visit thelivinghistoryproject.org. I'm Will Everett.
AM 580 has a listener comment line. If you'd like to comment on something you hear on the Information Advantage, call 217-333-0853 and leave a message. That's 217-333-0853.
Carry AM 580 News with you. The AM 580 News Daily Podcast is updated every weekday morning with the latest news, an in-depth feature, and a look at the day's forecast from the WILL weather staff. Update your MP3 player every day, and you have AM 580's news coverage to hear at your leisure. Subscribe at WILL.UIUC.edu. The AM 580 News Daily Podcast, another service of WILL Urbana.
We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell.
The holiday forecast for Champaign-Urbana, there's a good chance of showers and thunderstorms today with a high around 80 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms likely tonight as well, the low 52. Cloudy skies tomorrow, a chance of showers. The high around 65, mostly cloudy tomorrow night, the low 48. Partly sunny Wednesday with a high of 68. Wednesday night and Thursday, mostly clear skies. The low around 45, the high 72 degrees. This is WILL Urbana.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston, Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. It takes about 45 minutes and saves lives. Information at 367-2202 or at bloodservices.org. Blood donation, it's about life.